What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Don't forget the current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
Welcome to Legal Face Off on WGN Plus. We are having a great panel today. We're going to cover the future of the Supreme Court with our esteemed Supreme Court panel. We'll be talking about the Justin Harris case involving the unfortunate death of a toddler in a car in Atlanta. We are having our regular Inside Out columnists, David Sussler, Tina Martini, join us shortly. We are also going to cover a variety of topics in our legal grab bag. Jason Whiteside, welcome. How are we doing?
Great. Fantastic. We got an excellent panel coming up here with to talk about the Supreme Court nominees and Trump. So looking forward to that.
We're missing our regular host today, Sam Panianiewicz.
He's on a secret assignment somewhere.
Yeah, to another legal radio show. But with that, we'll start with our Supreme Court panel. We're very honored today to be joined by very distinguished team. First, Professor Ronald Rotunda. Professor Rotunda is the Doy and D. Henley Chair and Distinguished Professor of Jurisprudence at Chapman University. Professor, thanks. Welcome back to Legal Face-Off.
Well, thank you.
Next, we've got Professor Lucas Poe. Professor Poe is the Ann Green Regents Chair in Law at University of Texas Law School. He's also Professor of Government. He is one of the leading historians of the Supreme Court and a regular guest on our show. Professor Poe, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And we've also got a return guest on Legal Face-Off. All three of our guests are return guests. Andy DeVoot with Loeb & Loeb. Andy was an assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois. He served as a law clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist on the Supreme Court and now represents a wide range of companies and individuals in complex business litigation. Andy, thanks for joining us again on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So let's get right to it. We've got a president-elect who will be taking the oath of office here in a few short weeks. One of the big issues was the Supreme Court and filling the vacancy created by the death of Antonin Scalia. Professor Rotunda, when do you think President-elect Trump will name a nominee?
This is just a guess, and I hate to make predictions because it's evidence of my fallibility. But I would think by the end of November, I think that's probably got to be pretty high in his list. He's already got a list of, I think it's 21, and I wouldn't be surprised it would be by the end of January.
So he's busy right now, high atop Trump Tower, dealing with, you know, a variety of cabinet appointments. Obviously, he did put forth a list, as you mentioned, several months ago of, I think it was 15 or 16 potential nominees. Professor Poe, how high on the Trump team's priority list do you think replacing Antonin Scalia is right now? Do you think it's behind Secretary of State and other cabinet appointments, or do you think it's fairly high up on that list right now?
I would hope it's behind the cabinet, of the important cabinet posts, because he's got to get a government functioning on January 20th. He can put off the nomination to the court, I think, till the end of January.
Okay. Andy, you know the list. We've covered it before on this show. Do you think that Trump is going to go, you know, fairly conservative, fairly hardcore with this first pick, understanding that by the end of his term, there will be three justices who are 80 or older, so it's likely that he'll get another shot at this. So do you think that is it possible he goes with Merrick Garland, who the current president nominated, or do you think he goes with someone on the list who is more attuned with the base of people that elected him? Where do you think he goes with this pick?
Sure. So, first of all, I don't think there's any chance he goes with Merrick Garland. I think that Judge Garland will go back to the D.C. Circuit and continue on as a judge on that court. In terms of, you know, he has said he will go off of this list, and I haven't had the chance to talk to you guys about this list. I have to say, from my opinion or my perspective, this was an incredibly shrewd move putting this list out. You have a list that did a number – by doing this, he accomplished a number of goals before the election. He worked with entities, the Federal Society, the Heritage Foundation. These are respected institutions in terms of the brightest conservative minds in the country. And you also have a number of people from key battleground states, right? When you look at that list, you look at the geography of where these individuals are from. And then you also have a lot of extremely qualified individuals. You know, Neil Gorsuch, a judge in the 10th Circuit, highly respected. Judge Ryan clerked for Justice Scalia the year before I did. So you've got a list of very qualified individuals from a lot of different states that Trump, President-elect Trump, had to win. You know, in terms of who he'll pick, so I think he'll pick someone off the list. In terms of who he picks, as Professor Rotunda said, you know, it's hard to guess. There are a couple on there that I don't think he'll pick yet because, for example, Amul Tabar right now is a district court judge, and I think that Amul Tabar likely would be elevated to the Sixth Circuit before he'd put on to the Supreme Court. I think it will likely be one of the judges from the federal courts of appeals, but there are a number of judges from state Supreme Courts. But I think it is very, very likely it'll be from the list of 21 people that they put together.
All right, I'll toss this question just out to the group. With the current makeup of the Senate, how difficult do you think it's going to be to get whoever he nominates passed through and approved?
I don't think it'll be difficult. If the Democrats decide to filibuster it, I think the Republicans will just strip the filibuster.
This is Ron. I think that's correct. You know, I think when people make their own bed, they have to lie in it. And with the ending of the filibuster for judges, except for Supreme Court justices under Harry Reid, there's not a lot of reason to engage in what unilateral disarmament. That is, if the Democrats are taking away the filibuster, I can't see the Republicans deciding to be bound by it.
Now, we've talked a lot on this show about the makeup of the current Supreme Court and how it's overwhelmingly populated by, you know, one or two religions, one or two geographic areas, Ivy League schools. How important do you think it'll be to the president to nominate someone who is more diverse in terms of their background? There are a couple of names on that list who are from, you know, different backgrounds. How important will that weigh into his decision? Andy, let's start with you on that.
Well, I think that he putting the list together was trying to send a message, again, I think in some key states, that was important to him, that you've got a number of individuals here on state courts now. Looking at those individuals, they're incredibly qualified. Dave Straws, you know, clerk for Judge Luttig, formerly of the Fourth Circuit, and then for Justice Thomas. So even though these individuals, a number are from state courts, let's be clear, their background, their pedigree, many of them still went to Harvard, Yale, Stanford, you know, had clerkships on the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals clerkships. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that if there's an individual that, I guess, not to jump ahead, but I'm just so curious, I think none of us knows, because none of us yet knows how he'll make that decision, right? There was a tweet yesterday at 3 a.m. that only he knows who the finalists are in cabinet positions. So I think it's going to be a factor. I think he'd like to, come through on that promise. But I think no one knows until he meets these individuals and he decides what he thinks is most important after meeting.
Let's talk about that. I mean, Andy, you were in these rooms, not obviously when the Chief Justice was being interviewed or you know, during the interview process. But I'm sure, you know, you talked to the Chief Justice about what that process is like. What do you think it's like? I mean, how long does Trump's team meet with these candidates? What are those questions like? Is there a litmus test? I mean, do they go to the specifics of, you know, how do you feel about Roe v. Wade? Obviously, they know that at this point to some degree because they know the history of these people on the list. But what are those meetings like?
Sure.
Let's have all of you weigh in on that if you can. Andy, let's start with you.
Sure. So, I mean, I think certainly all of these candidates have been heavily vetted by well-established entities with great resources, the Federalist Society, the Heritage Institution. And when you have a finite list, right, you can really work with that. And I think that you've got the Office of Legal Policy, other individuals in government who will be doing a lot of the heavy lifting. You know, I think every president, just like every judge, when a judge, and I know the professors can speak to this too, every judge or justice is very different in how they select someone because it's one of the more personal decisions, like selecting justice. It's a legacy. And similarly, having a law clerk in your chambers on a smaller level, you know, they're a part of your family for a year or two. So I think it's a very personal decision. I think every president has been and will be a little different. And I think you touched on, in terms of a litmus test, I mean, no, but I think one of the interesting things will be, when you nominate someone to be a Supreme Court justice, you're nominating the whole person. Right. It's not you can't go through and like making your Subway sandwich, pick and choose. You know, you'd like these toppings. Right. You'd like these viewpoints. You can to a certain extent, but you can't, across every issue. And so when you have, you see reports in The New York Times or these other papers talking about President Trump softening on this position or keeping this position on Roe v. Wade versus immigration, I think that's going to be another interesting part is the president having prioritized which of those issues is most important to him.
Professor Paul, you've studied Supreme Court nomination process and justices for years. You're one of the leading experts on this field. Does Trump flat out ask a potential nominee, will you overturn Roe v. Wade, for example?
No. And you can't say that Trump won't because Trump seems to be able to do everything. But traditionally, presidents don't ask that. But you find other markers that give you the answer. I assume that Trump will want somebody that's an originalist. And if you've got an originalist, you've got somebody who doesn't like Roe versus Wade. And so originalism can substitute as a proxy for Roe.
You know, Professor Rotunda, do we even know what criteria Trump is looking for in a nominee? I mean, he seems kind of unpredictable at times. Is there anything that you can
point
to?
Trump unpredictable?
Yeah, the whole elections are unpredictable. So do we know what criteria he's looking for?
I mean, he told us. I mean, he said he's like a judge like Justice Scalia. I mean, and the 21 judges on his list, I don't know all of them. I know of some of them, and they're roughly in that particular mode. It's become a political issue over the years, in part because the Democrats have made it a political issue. Every election, we're told, is going to be the end of Roe v. Wade. We also should take into account that we don't know today what the big issues will be 10 or 15 years from now. Much less what is the liberal or conservative or the Democratic or Republican answer. And so I think it's important to pick someone who seems to be thoughtful, give the parties a fair shake, keep an open mind as to what the arguments are, because nobody would have known even 10 years ago, and certainly when Justice Scalia was nominated, what would be the role of the Fourth Amendment and cell phones and smartphones. Phones were... in those days, were pretty dumb, and even the cell phones were not particularly smart. But that's become a big issue. In fact, Justice Scalia has been very good on both Fourth Amendment and making sure that the judge can't decide important issues of guilt. They have to go to the jury. He's been very good on free speech. Some of these issues now become, say, partisan. But you take Citizens United, which says that entities, whether they're unions or partnerships or corporations, cannot give money to a candidate, but they can spend on their independent views. That's a view, if you go back over the years, was embraced specifically by Justice William O. Douglas, Hugo Black, Chief Justice Earl Warren, Harry Truman, when he vetoed a bill that tried to prevent those kinds of that kind of campaign speech or political speech. Now this is considered a Democratic litmus test to overturn Citizens United. We don't know what these big issues are some years from now. We don't even know what our positions will be because we'd like to see them in context. And I think the list that President-elect Trump has given is shows people that are respected as jurors, even though you may not embrace every one of their decisions. And he said he's going to appoint somebody like this. And he's been very consistent about that. And I think if Hillary Clinton had been president-elect, she would appoint the people that she wants. And she said two criteria, were several, I guess. It was extend Roe v. Wade, to overturn the Second Amendment, and to the Second Amendment cases, and then overturn Citizens United.
All right, with the time we have left, which is limited, we're going to ask you all to give us a one-word answer to this question. How many justices does a President Trump get to elect by the end of his presidency? Professor Rotunda.
I guess one more, two total.
Two total. Professor Poe.
One in the first term, one more in the second term.
Andy?
I'm going to say two as well. I think that's right.
All right. That's our Supreme Court panel. Professor Ronald Rotunda, Chapman, www.chapman.edu. Professor Lucas Poe, utexas.edu. Andy DevoteLoeb.com. Thank you for joining us. We'll have you back on as this issue develops.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. Talking now to Professor David Diamond about the Justin Ross Harris case. We've covered this extensively on the show. On Monday of this week, a jury in Georgia found Justin Ross Harris guilty of murder in the 2014 death of his 22-month-old son, Cooper. Harris was accused of intentionally locking his son inside a hot car for 7 hours. On that same day, he was sexting with six women, including one minor, according to phone records. In addition to three counts of murder, Harris was found guilty by a jury of two counts of cruelty to children for Cooper's death, and also three counts relating to his electronic exchanges of lewd material. Professor David Diamond, you are an expert in this field. Tell us your feelings on what the jury did in this case.
Well, I think in this case, the jury was very much influenced by the illicit activities he had. And in a sense, I think they wanted to punish him for that. And I think they went well beyond the evidence in the case.
Why do you think that? I know that, you know, for example, one of the big prosecution pieces of evidence was this website where Harris allegedly looked at in terms of how to, you know, get rid of your son or how to not be a parent. And it turns out that was something simply that was sent to him. So that was a piece of evidence that wasn't exactly the way it appeared. Why do you think the other evidence presented by the state wasn't strong enough to convict him?
Right. From the beginning, you have the impression that he had run an internet search on leaving children in cars, that he wanted to leave his wife, he wanted to be without his child, that he had actually gone back to the car to see the progress in how his child was dying as a result of being left in the car. It all seemed to be part of a nefarious plan that he had come up with. And I didn't see that at all. I had watched the trial, and I didn't see any evidence of that at all. There wasn't an internet search on how to basically leave your child in a car. He didn't go back to the car and actually look at the progress. He had dropped something off at the car. You can see from the video that was shown that he didn't look in the car at all. No, I think this is consistent with the other cases that I've been involved in which parents do lose awareness of their children in their cars. And all the evidence in this case, to me, points to this being very similar to the hundreds of other parents that have lost awareness of children in their cars. And as a result of that, the children die of hypothermia. Now, one other factor was how quickly it was that he forgot his child in a car. And it happened within a matter of minutes. Put his child in a car and went off to work and then said he forgot that the child was in his car. This, again, is consistent with so many other cases in which parents very quickly lose awareness of the children in their cars.
Professor, I'm going to jump in on that topic. We talked about it off air a little bit, but how do they lose awareness of a child in the car? I mean, I could see maybe if the child's sleeping, but I mean, if it's an active toddler who's, you know, 1 to 3 or 4, they're pretty rambunctious in the car. And how on earth can they lose track of the fact that they have a child in the car?
Right. I know how difficult that is to understand. And the first time I learned of a child being forgotten in the car, I have to admit I was pretty judgmental at the time, too. But what I've studied over the past 12 years is there's just a unique set of circumstances you find in these cases, a very consistent pattern. And you're right. If you've got a rambunctious child in a car, there's just no way you're forgetting that child, of course. And so what you have to see is that there is a pattern. And, in fact, the memory expert that testified in this case did try to talk about that and talked about his research on how quickly we can forget important items. But in these cases, what you're finding is this pattern, and I've written about this, in which the child always is sleeping, or at least is very quiet for the duration of the drive, and there's no interaction between the parent and the child. It just happens to be a drive in which the child is sleeping. The parent is going through some kind of routine that typically does not include the child on that drive. So in the Ross Harris case, when he's leaving Chick-fil-A, pretty much every time he is going from the Chick-fil-A directly to work. So that was his pattern. And so it was clearly not a part of his pattern to go from Chick-fil-A to daycare. Normally he would go straight from home, go to daycare, and then he would either go to work or he'd go to Chick-fil-A and then to work. And so I think part of it is the brain takes over, goes into this autopilot mode, in which we then do something automatically without thinking about it.
But what about the evidence? What about the evidence in this case presented by the prosecution that I think it was 10 minutes before he left the car, he was sexting and used words to the effect of, you know, yes, I love my son, but we all need a break sometime. I mean, that obviously had some sway over the jury. Did you find that at all persuasive?
You know, they looked at absolutely everything he had texted for years before that. He looked at every single search that he ran on the internet. And that, to me, was the worst thing that he had texted, which to me comes across as benign. It's the kind of thing that someone would text when you're simply connecting to someone else. There's never been anything that he showed that had any malice toward his child, that he ever wanted to be free of his child. I look at that as just the kind of, again, I use the word benign because I think that's just his way of socializing with someone else.
So you referenced it earlier that maybe the jury was swayed by some other evidence. To me, you know, as someone who tries a lot of jury cases, Jason does also, you know, we'll be the first to say that the jury does not always look at the evidence, and they're often persuaded by...
Nor do they actually apply the law.
Yeah, I mean, you know, good or bad, you know, you're always, I think, surprised when you talk to a jury afterwards, which we normally do, about what they focus in on. In this case, I think to your point earlier, you know, what they were persuaded by, was, or at least partially from my opinion, in my opinion, was the wife's testimony. The wife was called to the stand by the defense. She refused to testify on behalf of the prosecution. And when she was called by the defense, she said, basically, he was a crappy husband, but was a good father. But I think the jury, you know, probably was persuaded by the fact that he wasn't a good husband. And even though she testified and there was evidence and there was videos of him being a good dad, I think ultimately the jury looked at this guy as someone they couldn't sympathize with because he wasn't a great husband per his own wife.
I think also the problem was that despite his ex-wife testifying for him and for the defense, the jury probably felt that since he appeared to have this double life that the state created, that she really didn't know him well enough, and so that they may have viewed that he was still capable of killing his child, and his wife wouldn't know that. But they did see so much tape, so much video, and all the photos of how loving he was with his child. So you've got to believe, I guess, to find him guilty, that here's this man who shows nothing but love to his child, and somehow he becomes a psychopath and just wants to kill the child. And that's apparently what the jury wanted to believe. I do believe the jury wanted to punish him for his illicit behavior.
All right, Professor, last question I have for you is, are we seeing more incidents of these hot car deaths, or is it just the news cycle actually speeding up and we're able to pick up on these quicker and faster? To me, it seems like there's an uptick in the last couple of years.
I think there's been more awareness of the phenomenon, but it's actually been going on at a relatively stable rate for about the last 15 to 20 years. And it all really began in the 1990s with the development of airbags, because then children at that time were put into the back seat. And you can see at the kidsincars.org website that you can see child deaths from hyperthermia spiked up once children were being put in the back seat. And so around the year 2000, you can see it's increased dramatically. And it's been pretty stable since that time. So this is clearly related to parents putting children in the backseat, especially if they're facing the rear. So you don't see the child, you don't hear the child, you lose awareness of the child in the car.
Professor David Diamond, author of The Conversation, also professor of psychology, cognitive, neural, and social division at the University of South Florida, a leading expert in this field. You were quoted in a CNN article that's just published today. Is that true?
That's true, yes.
Thank you very much, Professor Diamond, for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks, Professor.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off, high atop historic Tribune Tower here on the Mag Mile in beautiful downtown Chicago. We are about to get to our legal grab bag, but before that, one of our favorite our favorite pieces on Legal Face-Off is Inside Out. We've got regular Inside Out columnist David Sessler and Tina Martini. They both co-author the Inside Out column for Chicago Lawyer Magazine. Welcome back to Legal Face-Off.
Hi.
Thank
how
you.
Are you?
So Tina is chair of the Chicago Intellectual Property Practice Group and the national hiring partner of Associate Recruiting at DLA Piper. Also sits on its executive committee, and David Sessler, who is also, in addition to Tina's co-author, her husband, is Associate General Counsel with National Material LP. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're talking today about your latest column in the October 2016 edition of Chicago Lawyer, titled Partnering with the Business. So I've said for years, as an attorney who represents many businesses, that my role is not as a lawyer, it's as a business partner first. Certainly, I provide legal services, but I pride myself on being a business partner first, and legal services is one of the services that I provide. How do you feel about that? David, let's talk to you first about someone who hires outside counsel. What are you looking for in an attorney and a business partner?
Well, to do exactly what you just said, to somebody who is interested in learning my business and understanding my needs as a business, not just in providing a black letter law answer.
Why is that important to you?
Well, the way that I often put it is businesses don't have legal problems. They have business problems with legal aspects.
and our legal issues. So our legal issues don't occur in a vacuum, and I'm looking for a lawyer to partner with who will help me give the right legal answer for the business.
So, Tina, you're on the other side. You're someone who people like David will hire as outside counsel. What do you do to show your clients that you are interested in providing business advice first and being a partner first before just being an attorney?
A lot of it is driven by the questions that I ask. First and foremost, we need to understand the meets and bounds of what the legal assignment is. If it's a new client that I'm not particularly familiar with their business, I'll do some due diligence on the front end before I have a conversation with them to understand their company. But then I start asking a lot of questions about the importance of the project, who the players are that are involved at the client, try to gauge and understand my client contact and how they fit into that whole dynamic, and try to understand how these folks define success. So it's getting to the right legal answer, but it's also understanding where they want to get to as well.
So, David, your company's engaged primarily in steel processing and aluminum extrusion based here in Chicagoland area. You've got lots of outside attorneys coming to you frequently asking to be hired by you and your company. How do you determine who is going to be a true business partner versus someone who's just providing a legal service to you?
Well, you know, to some extent, it depends upon the issue and the nature involved. But a lot of it is going to come down to doing what Tina said. The lawyer who demonstrates they've done some proactive work in advance and really gotten to know what my company is about, and then starts asking me some good questions to flesh out the information they may have found online, I'm going to be more interested in somebody like that versus somebody who just says, oh, yes, I've done this many times before. I can do it.
All right, Tina, I'm going to put you on the spot here, all right?
You've never done that before.
It's called legal face-off, after all.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask you, obviously, you know, within the bounds of confidentiality and that, give us a situation with a client where you found it was a challenging business opportunity and, you know, something that was outside the box.
I'd be happy to. So I have a client who it's going on now 2 years ago, came to me with an issue that was framed as an intellectual property trademark issue. And so I was asked to work in tandem with their outside labor and employment counsel to put together a couple of trademark counts in a complaint. After I looked at the complaint, I realized that it was a lot more than just a trademark infringement, that it actually involved a labor union and had some very tricky ramifications as a result. It actually kept me up at night a couple nights, and that's how I sort of knew with my spidey sense that there was something else going on. So I went back to the general counsel of the client and started asking a couple of questions and did some due diligence with respect to capabilities on my firm side, and realized that the approach and the tack that the client wanted to take was actually not the right one. And as a result, we were able to make this into a significant matter for the firm, because I had somebody on standby who has a lot of experience with this type of situation, and it's a very tricky situation, and was able to step in and give the client counsel in something that they didn't really have much experience in. But it was using my spidey sense, understanding the client, because I've worked with them for a number of years and what their sensitivities are, that sort of kept me up at night and helped me process what the right approach was, even though it's in an area that I have no experience in at all.
I love as litigation attorneys, we're blessed with that 3 a.m. wake up where your mind just starts racing with what you forgot to do or what you should be doing.
Speaking of 3 a.m. wake ups, and we just covered the presidential election extensively. I heard a great quote, totally off topic, but a great quote that, who would have thought that Hillary's first 3 a.m. call would be her concession call?
Oh, man.
Remember her for her whole, you know, who do you want taking that 3 a.m. phone call ad?
Oh, that's bad.
Anyway, back to our topic, partnering with business. I don't think you could talk about this subject and not talk about legal fees, because that's one of the leading drivers of costs involved in hiring lawyers. Of course, you know, we're all well worth it. But how do you reconcile the inherent conflict, I think, you know, involved in seeing yourself as a business partner concerned with your client's bottom line and also be an attorney who bills for their time? David, how do you reconcile those two things as someone who hires attorneys and pays them for their time?
Well, it's actually pretty easy for me. That's sort of the whole concept behind the ACC value challenge, is ensuring that there is value in it. Now, value means different things in different settings, but to have an attorney who does what Tina just described doing in real, you know, realizing what my needs are better than I do. And I have had that experience in the past when I've been able to hire Tina and her firm. When I have a lawyer who really understands my needs and is working towards a solution on the merits rather than just billing hours, then there's value in there. You know, I'll talk about things like how do you staff a matter? You know, if you're going to throw 100 lawyers at me, or are you going to throw one or two substantive experts at me? And I can get a lot of that out of an initial meeting with a new lawyer, just to get a sense of them as a person and how they work and how their firm works. But of course, you also build that over time. When you build a relationship, it takes time to partner, to build a true partnership. And I get to know the way the lawyer works and the firm works.
Tina, about a minute left here on Legal Face-Off. How do you reconcile providing business services to your clients and considering their bottom line with also your need to bill for your time?
Well, I think that's a great question. I would say that it's like an optimization exercise like most other things. So what I try to do is have that conversation on the front end before we actually start billing time, to try to gauge whether the client has any expectations about what the final bill is going to look like. There have been instances where I've actually turned down work because the client, either from the legal department side or from the business side, has expectations as to and demands as to what the final bill will look like. And I just know that there's more work that will go into it. And I will tell them, you know, sometimes you may have to either consider doing this in-house or maybe another legal solution. So I think the best thing to do is ask specifically if there are any expectations about what the budget will look like, and do my best to work within that, but understand that sometimes it's not possible.
We can't end any.
Can I?
Yeah, of course.
Can
jump in.
Throw in real quick? Part of it also is as an in-house attorney, partnering with my business clients internally to understand what is the importance and value of the work to my company, and that gives me a better ability to talk with outside counsel about what I want the bill to look like. And look, they have to, my outside counsel has to make a living. They deserve to make a profit. And I need them to do that so that I can call on them to be my lawyer.
We'd be remiss in ending any Inside Out segment without asking this couple about their passion for Springsteen. Will you be attending the Presidential Medal of Freedom ceremony? It was just announced yesterday by President Obama that among the winners of this year's Presidential Medal of Freedom, well-deserved, is Bruce Springsteen.
Excellent.
So will I see a Martini Sussler invite from the White House imminently?
I'm looking for it, and if I don't get there in person, I plan to be on the live stream.
Well, and if I don't get it, I'll just wait for my invitation from a certain Rich Lankoff to join him.
Yes, I'll be there for sure.
Rich tends to make it to those large events somehow.
He does.
I don't know how.
Somehow. We won't talk about how. That's Inside Out. That's Tina Martini. And that's Dave Sussler. If you want to submit a question for future columns, email them at questions.insideout@gmail.com. You can find their columns in Chicago Lawyer. The latest one, Partnering with the Business, is in October 2016. Tina, David, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We end off each Legal Face-Off, as we do every week, with a legal grab bag, everyone's favorite part of the show. Seven topics ripped from today's headlines. Start off today with former Congressman Aaron Schock from downstate Illinois, indicted this week for a variety of criminal counts, 24 to be exact. We have covered Aaron Schock before in this show. He resigned from Congress after a very rapid ascent through Congress. He was one of the youngest congressmen ever elected.
Darlings of the Republican Party.
Yeah, very a man very concerned about his image. He was pictured very famously without his shirt a couple times.
Yeah, lots of times.
And decorated his office in the style of Downton Abbey. Well, it turns out that that was all being done with the money that he was supposed to be using for his campaign.
Yeah, so a lot of his defense, too, is that, you know, it was just it was a mistake. It was oversight. But if you start reading, there's a lot of personal jet travel that he wrote off. He was going to be late for a connection going overseas for a personal trip. So he wrote that $8,000 private jet expense off. He bought a car for one of his staff members that wasn't even used for the campaign, used campaign funds for it. So there's at first blush, it sounds like he just made a lot of mistakes and the government's, you know, on a witch hunt. But when you actually read the accounts of the indictment, there's quite a bit that he misappropriated or was in the wrong column on the old expense sheet.
I thought you were going to say that these were all just innocent mistakes until you qualified it by saying that the 24 counts are actually
the 52-page indictment that came down against him.
If you read it, I mean, you know, paying for, like you said, travel to get a haircut, private airplanes, cars,
and
rent.
And then a fictitious bank account down in Florida called Global Travel International, where he paid himself $4,500 from the account. And even after he resigned,
well, that's
he
the
was
greatest
still,
part. After he resigned, he was still
spending money from the government.
Used campaign funds to attend the American Country Music Awards in Dallas.
I can't knock him for that. Probably a good event.
Yeah. But, you know, has come out and said that this is just, he's one of the many Americans, he said, that is the victim of malicious prosecution. So.
It's like anti-Trumpism, right?
Exactly.
That's what he's.
Moving on to, speaking of Trump, Trump, obviously, we covered him earlier in the show. He is still being sued by many people. One of the interesting questions will be whether a sitting president can be deposed for a civil suit. There was a motion to continue his trial that was filed this week.
Jason. Yeah, the judges actually, the parties had requested, well, the defense had requested that they continue the trial. The judge recommended that the parties sit down and settle this so that, you know, it doesn't even go to trial because obviously it's going to be, I think it'll set precedence as one of the first times a sitting president could potentially be on a civil, be a defendant in a civil jury trial.
And this is the trial for his Trump
University,
U, right?
Yeah, Trump University. That allegedly the plaintiffs have alleged that he swindled them out of money, didn't fulfill promises that they were supposed to get out of Trump University. So I think anyone knows that those legal classes, though, where you're going to be buying millions of dollars in real estate with no money down, doesn't actually work.
More elected officials in the news. We breaking last couple of days is here in Chicago. Ed Radoliak, who is not only a an attorney, but who is a former alderman here, was very famous during the aldermanic wars back in the 70s. He was a very prominent opponent of former Mayor of Chicago Harold Washington. He just a couple of years ago served some prison time.
He just completed a 10-month sentence.
Right,
for
now he has again been indicted on a tax charge. What's that all about?
This is a crazy story. So the government has alleged that Eddie Radoliak somehow he muscled his way into a, I don't know if you want to call it a kickback or a fee off the tobacco litigation that resolved some years ago, and he was supposed to earn allegedly $65 million off this tobacco litigation. He didn't work on the tobacco litigation. He didn't have anything to do with it.
Minor detail. Yeah. You can take a fee off
something.
Hey, Rich,
would you like a $65 million referral fee?
That's really nitpicking, isn't it?
Yeah, you know the government these days with their intrusion. So he got caught up in that, and they're alleging that he didn't do any work to earn that. But one of the attorneys that did some work on it, Radoliak was somehow paying approximately, I think it was about $170,000 they had caught. He was paying this attorney named Soso. And so the IRS sent a letter to Radoliak and said, hey, listen, you know, Soso owes us money for back taxes to the tune of about $780,000. So if you are going to pay him any more money, simply send that to the IRS. Radoliak sends a letter to them saying that he doesn't owe him any more money. It's all over with. And then they're alleging that they continue to pay Soso checks through relatives' accounts, fictitious bank accounts, all that stuff.
I mean, this money could go a long way in prison, though. I mean,
yeah,
you know, you got to
figure, a lot,
like,
of smokes.
Yeah, Verdoliak is sitting there like in Goodfellas, you know, cutting the garlic with the razor, and
at least,
you know,
he
waiting
knows
for the
system.
Red wine. Now we could eat.
He should just go to his prison account and refill it right now, just in case.
Moving on to making a murderer, a topic that we've covered extensively on this show. We've had a lot of the reporters who have covered this case. You know, we all know the story that was on Netflix, one of the most watched documentaries in history.
Well, part two is coming
breaking
up
news. Soon. Yeah, part two is coming out. Breaking news this week is that Brendan Dassey, who was the nephew, who was also convicted, has now been found by a federal judge to have had his confession coerced and is ordered to be released. I think he's going to be released tomorrow is what I understand.
Yeah, as long as he provided an address to the court, he was going to be able to be released.
I hope it's not that that
the
creepy
junkyard
farm.
Yeah, the junkyard up in north of Wausau, Wisconsin. Yeah, you know, it's incredible, though. I know the whole entire documentary was shot in a way, you know, like most favorable to Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey, but I don't think you can help but wonder, as an attorney, too, how Brendan Dassey was even allowed to be interviewed, have his attorney, you know, do what he did to him, and still somehow spend 10 years in prison. So,
I mean, fairly clear that he was mentally unfit. I think his IQ was like under 70, and, you know, to be even competent to give a confession, he has to be over 75 at least.
Yeah. And he was a minor at the time, too. And I know in the documentary they said that it's okay in the state of Wisconsin. I checked up, it's not. It's still not okay. So, yeah, there's a lot of missteps there by the prosecution, and then his own attorney hanging him out to dry and letting the investigator quiz him on behalf of the prosecution, which
is
astounding.
Local attorney here, Kathleen Zellner, is now representing his uncle.
Yeah, very well-known attorney who specializes in overturning these convictions and also large civil lawsuits as a result thereof.
Yeah, so because the movie, you know, ultimately had a large part in resulting in this decision to release Dassey. One of the questions, obviously, is whether Avery will be released. He obviously has motions pending to look at a sentence again. We'll see. I mean, certainly, as you mentioned, the documentary does make it clear that this was not a conviction that adhered to the laws of evidence. Of course, you know, the prosecutors have come out and said that that's not an accurate depiction. So we'll see. We'll continue to watch the story. Moving on to Drew Peterson. What's going on with him?
Well, Drew Peterson somehow continues to be in the spotlight. His appeal is up now on the murder conviction that he received in 2012 when he had the trial and was ultimately convicted and received a 38-year prison sentence. And then he had 40 years added on to it after he was found guilty in a murder-for-hire plot against the state's attorney, James Glasgow. So it's up on appeal right now. As we've covered on the show before, there was an interesting twist during the trial. There was an interlocutory appeal to the Supreme Court regarding whether statements made by a decedent can be admitted into trial. And they did allow statements that were someone else said they overheard Stacey Peterson, his deceased wife, say that was detrimental to Drew Peterson during the trial. So that's going up on appeal, and as well as his conviction of 38 years.
Moving on to celebrities in the news. Celebrity lawsuits, celebrities in trouble. Tracy Morgan, we all know, was involved in an accident, huge accident in the summer of 2014 with a Walmart truck. Tracy Morgan was seriously injured in the accident, and his friend James McNair was killed. Morgan was on Conan O'Brien, on the Conan O'Brien show, and talked about him forgiving the driver that was involved. He said, "I'm not even mad at him no more." I would say that a $90 million settlement probably goes a long way towards
Tracy Morgan did not make that much money in his life at all in his stand-up comedy or SNL. So I'm sure that those zeros, you know, every zero that was added onto it bought some forgiveness from Tracy Morgan.
Yeah, I mean, there was a criminal trial, obviously, and that resulted in or actually, that is now ongoing, I should say. The driver has pled not guilty. But, yeah, $90 million is the reported number. It was confidential.
Is that like a day's earnings for Walmart? Or
it's
an hour?
It's a lot of money, but big corporation. Finally, we'll end off the show with Madonna in the news. Madonna has been involved in a legal battle with her co-op. In New York, you have to have the board approve your residency. So Madonna is alleging that she should be able to live in this building.
Yeah, and also there another twist on it is that she said that this building known as Harper Lee Hall is one of her houses, one of her many homes throughout the world. And at some point in time, they illegally changed her original proprietary lease back in 2014 to have this weird requirement that anyone under the age of 16 could only live in the apartment if someone over the age of 21 was present. And so it's created this gray area where some of Madonna's children who are under the age of 16 are unable to live there while she's not there, even with Lourdes, who's 19 years old. So there's an ongoing battle back and forth with Madonna and the board.
Thanks for listening on Legal Face-Off. As always, we appreciate it. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our host, Sam Panianovich. Be sure to listen to Legal Face-Off on iTunes. Search Legal Face-Off. You can also find us on Facebook at Legal Face-Off. Follow us on Twitter at The Legal Face-Off. And we'll be moving to the big house, WGN, fairly soon. So with that, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.